Some reflections from last week for those of us who were here last week. And may I ask the four of you to just sit one row forward so that, because you know there's going to be people coming. Thank you. It's the same thing. All right. And you three too, please. Yeah. Okay. A verbal summary of last week. Yeah, he's bringing, the stuff. So we were basically talking about how England was the first country to industrialize in a serious way in the mid-1700s. They had like a 100-year head start compared to other Western nations. And actually, we didn't mention this last week, but it took a long time for Great Britain to become competitive with China and India in the manufacture of clothing, actually, textiles, because they just did it better. They had better technology. And there was a lot of kind of corruption, too, involved to make them competitive by hurting, you know, by colonizing these other nations and crippling their economies in serious ways. But in any case, compared to other European nations, England had a head start, and Adam Smith began to develop theories. And instead of economics being oikonomia, or household management, he turned it kind of into a science, and measuring supply and demand and how all that works. And just let it be. Thank you. Because I know you're an economics professor, but we're doing economics for dummies, including myself. All right? So we're basically laying the basic groundwork up to the 19th century, up to the early 20th century to get to where we are now. So some questions or comments from last week for those of you who were here.
Add something?
Mm-hmm.
One of the other major things we talked about was how war became a key strategy to keep people focused on an enemy abroad instead of the exploitation that was happening to them at home.
Right. One of the things we talked about last week, thank you, was that there were a lot of religious wars up to the mid-1600s, and the religious wars were just so devastating that instead of being Protestant or Catholic, people started to draw national boundaries. France was already ahead of the game in that way, but more and more nation states emerged. It wasn't until the late 19th century that Italy became a nation state and Germany became a nation state. But in any case, now wars were being fought not along religious lines, but along national lines with national boundaries. Economics then was also being reformulated with that movement. Comments from last week or last 2 weeks?
I was curious about your opinion on how, my understanding of the development of nations and economies has a lot to do with basically Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel.
Mm-hmm.
How does that overlay or contrast in this understanding?
Oh, great question. I think he takes a more sociological, an anthropological, sociological approach. It's probably, I see it as parallel analyses that don't necessarily contradict each other, but are actually helpful. I think so. He really talks about how in certain zones of the world that you have certain kind of crops that grow, but especially certain kind of animals, domesticable animals, and that makes all the difference in the world. So there are some areas where you have horsepower and other places in the world where no animal can, do that kind of pulling, or oxen, things like that. So, and how that basically saving labor and increasing yield in agriculture allows for levels of exploitation that would be impossible in other parts of the world. So the rise of empires, city-states and empires. Thank you. Other questions or comments?
Yeah. Well, so I've been thinking about a lot, but I think I kind of, I mean, I'm kind of economic, like, not very smart, which maybe makes me a good person after John said that economic majors are not very nice people or something. I don't know. But it was research-based, I'm pretty sure. But I've been thinking a lot about, like, the difference between what FDR brought and then what you're talking about, the neoliberal, and then I was listening to NPR yesterday, and they were talking about infrastructure and this new infrastructure bill that Trump was bringing, and talked about how what he wants to do is build a bunch of new roads, and really what needs to happen is repair of the roads that we already have. And they talked about the difference between, like, how we see every road that's built as an asset, like, okay, now we can make money by building homes in this area and all this stuff, and they don't see repair of old roads as assets, so they don't put any money into it.
New assets,
right. And so they talked about how really each road laid down should be looked at as a liability instead of an asset. And then it made me, like, start to to be able to see it like live played out made last week make more sense, and also make that radio show make more sense to me than it would have.
Wonderful.
Trump cut, it's not new road or old road, Trump cut 30% of budget of infrastructure. So he was talk so much, but actual number decreased.
Wow, that's good to know.
But then it's also for new things
instead of care.
And then right after that, they started to talk about ICE and detainment. And then, again, it was all about, like, well, these privatized prisons are getting credit, like, getting benefits, money for these. And so, you know, it's incentivizing them to keep them. And it just, I don't know, everything started to make a lot more sense.
That's a really great point you bring up. Because, yes, there's going to be benefits if you repair a road, right? There might be more travel or commerce happening because the roads are smoother, possibly. But basically, businesses, homes have already been built out. But you make a new road and a new development, and then businesses and homes will organize around that. And the economic output of that is so many more times, you know, many magnitude compared to repairing existing infrastructure. So there's plenty of homes, actually, you know, out there. Not as the stock isn't as great, but there's always a pressure to build new homes from the government's point of view because of the ripple effects of that kind of investment. So we're very much, so capitalism is a throwaway economic system. And the problem is that it assumes that the earth has limitless resources and it's endlessly renewable, which is just not true. So we're going to get into that here. But just to remind ourselves that there are certain industries like home building and car making that is just such a big industry that when you sell a car, you're not only, like, let's say a car is $30,000, you're generating hundreds of thousands of dollars of economic output because of the part suppliers and then the other people that supply the parts and then the raw materials makers. So there's a, you know, like if you were to buy leather shoes, that has some economic impact. But, you know, you basically skin a cow and then do some things and then you get shoes. But you know, by the time you have a car, I mean, there's just so many stages before that. So that's why the U.S. government would bail out Chrysler in the 80s and GM in the 2000s, right? Like, since when does the U.S. pick one particular company to bail out of bankruptcy, right? But it's because of that kind of impact. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying there's that kind of thing. All right. Well, let's get going then. I'll start with prayer. Lord, thank you for gathering us on this day, and we pray, Lord, for your wisdom and your guidance. We humbly acknowledge that we do not know much. You know everything. We see through a glass darkly, and we gather together as friends and sisters and brothers, as colleagues, as fellow disciples, to see if we can put some pieces together for a deeper understanding so that we would have the courage to act. And that's really what it's all about, that we would have a sufficient grasp of these complicated things, enough to find our voice, to speak the truth, so that your truth will set your world free. Be with us this evening, O Lord. Give us humble hearts, open minds to receive all that you would have to fill us with, and glad hearts to share this time together. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, in previous weeks, we have tried to paint the big picture in a kind of a small way and then go through the details. This week, we're doing the reverse. We're really trying to spell out the big picture best we can. It's not difficult. All of us have access to dictionary definitions of all kinds of economic terms at our fingertips, right? But even those definitions don't actually make sense if we don't have the background, right? So this is an incredibly challenging thing, to take something as complicated as our modern economic system and make it understandable to people with a ninth grade economics education. Because how many of us took an economics class in 10th grade, for instance, or 11th grade? Yeah.
I never had an economics class.
So how many of us have never had an economics class, ever? Yeah.
Mine was one trimester, so I'm not sure how
many. Not even a semester. That's what is called a quarter, right? So.
Some of the people went to school before.
All right, stop the taunting back there. Well, you know, yeah. I come from a school system where we had corporal punishment, so just letting you know. All right. It was first grade. I don't know why, I went to first grade in Korea, and I don't know why I got hit on my hand by a ruler every single day by the teacher. And one time I told my mom about it, who herself was a teacher, and knew my first grade teacher. They were friends. And my dad was also a teacher. And I just said, yeah, I go to school, and in the morning I get hit every day. There's different kids that rotate getting hit, but I'm hit consistently every day. And she's like, what's going on? As I was telling my mom, it finally dawned on me that I was not doing my homework. And all I had to do was do my homework and not stop getting hit. But I never connected that, you know, crime and punishment kind of thing. So anyway, I was kind of a late bloomer, but don't judge me. It was supply and demand was what it was. Right. Yeah. That was my first economics lesson right there. I didn't even know it. And Brian was a business professor for 20 years. So we got, and David is an economics professor for a number of years. We've got some really smart people here. So anyway, trying to communicate this to people with barely one trimester of economics class. You know what I mean? Like, if I can reach Lori, then we've succeeded. Lori's our litmus test. Okay. So, foundations of the neoliberal order. By the way, how do you like this quote at the top? The chief business of the American people is business, said President Calvin Coolidge, 1925. It has been paraphrased as, the business of America is business. You've heard that? But this is the actual quote. And it's so true. It is so true. Like, the whole American government is designed to be a massive federal chamber of commerce for our corporations. How many of us knew that, right? And it has only increased. So let me just read this big picture, because we said it very, very efficiently, I think. Neoliberalism may be described as a muscular capitalism, a conviction that a combination of privatization and deregulation of industry is the optimal path to economic growth. I got to stop right there because there's a lot right there, right? So what do we mean by muscular capitalism? It's what we talked about, capitalism being on steroids. It's capitalism on steroids, okay? And then what is privatization? It's instead of the government, whether it's local or federal, operating things directly, you basically let a private company do it. For instance, in the past, cities used to operate their own garbage collection. The cities would buy garbage trucks and hire employees, city employees, and they would go collect garbage. There was only one garbage collector company, right? But then many, many cities decided to privatize and let companies compete with each other. And by the way, there are some cities where you still, even though it's privatized, you don't have any competition. There's only one garbage collecting company in the whole city because other companies don't feel like it's worth competing over. And if you do compete with that one company, both of you can lose money because you're, you know, competing on price. So I think Columbia Heights has one. And whereas where I live in New Brighton, there's like three or four garbage collecting companies, you know, and it's really funny because on a certain day, there's multiple trucks, you know, going around our cul-de-sac again and again, really loud. So privatization is making ownership in private companies' hands. Now, the word private is kind of a tricky word because there's public and private. Right? And public means government and private means corporation. But then there's publicly traded companies and privately owned companies, right? So for instance, Home Depot is a publicly traded company, meaning you can buy and sell stocks, shares of Home Depot on Wall Street. Whereas Menards is privately owned by billionaires in Wisconsin, right? And they're not the Koch brothers, they're different right-wing people. So those kinds of words can get confusing. Right, like I think Josiah works for a pretty big corporation that's nevertheless privately owned. So, in our class, we're not getting into microeconomics, like what kind of a company, whether it's publicly traded or privately owned. We're talking about the difference between government and corporations, or the public sector and the private sector. So, all corporations, whether they're publicly traded or privately held, will be considered private. Got it? Is that clear? And then the deregulation of industry means that you put less rules and regulations on industry, right? Like for instance, we're all under regulation right now that we are to recycle paper and plastics, bottles, things like that, right? Now, if we don't do it well, there are certain levels of penalty, including maybe no penalty. But in any case, there's a regulation about that. There's all kinds of regulations about driving, for instance, right? And driving regulations are more stringently enforced than, say, recycling regulations. But believe it or not, we private citizens live under a slew of regulations on a daily basis that we've just so internalized and used to that we're not even aware that we're following hundreds, if not thousands, of regulations on a day-to-day basis. Corporations also have regulations. If we didn't have corporate regulations for corporations, do you know what kind of meat we would be eating? Anybody ever read the book The Jungle by Upton Sinclair? That's the kind of meat we would be eating from Chicago meatpacking companies where rat dung is all over the place, right? And meat is rotting, and then they just put red paint over it, you know? So regulations is a matter of life and death. Of course, for the corporation, the less rules there are, the more money it can make. Because, you know, providing not rotten meat or providing things that work like they're supposed to and all that costs more money than just throwing all kinds of junk out there, you know, and consumer beware kind of thing. So the deregulation of industry means less rules, less regulations, so that the corporation makes more money. And imagine if instead of paying for garbage collection, we just got to throw garbage in our neighbor's yard, right? And they get to do the same to us. We would all be saving $20, $30 a month in garbage collection fees, right? So deregulation also would be more profitable for us too. So it's interesting that in America, we don't believe in deregulating people's private lives, but for whatever reason, a whole bunch of people, mostly political conservatives, believe in deregulating corporations because they think that it's going to lead to more profits for corporations, which means more jobs for us, which historically does actually not work that way, right? But that's the line. That's the propaganda. All right. How about we move on to the second sentence? How do people feel about that?
But wait.
Oh, no, there's an objection there. Okay, let's stay on the first. Okay, so.
Regulatory capture too?
I think that's a little bit too detailed. Thank you, though. In other words, less power to government, known for waste. I mean, this is the party line. And more power to corporations, known for efficiency. Austrian economist Friedrich A. Hayek, a Nobel Prize winner in 1974 for economics, was convinced that the West was on the road to serfdom, a book he published in 1944, by the way, same year as the Bretton Woods Conference, which we'll talk about later, a pernicious slide into fascism and socialism a la Germany and Russia, similar to Germany and Russia. He strongly opposed Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal welfare programs, which he thought was ruining capitalism, by sneaking in socialist wealth redistribution through the back door, right? In 1947, 2 years after the end of World War II, Hayek helped found the Mont Pelerin Society in Switzerland, or is it Austria, to recruit the very wealthy as their interests aligned and to propagate neoliberal ideas in think tanks like the Brookings Institution and Cato Institute and economics departments of higher education around the world, especially the University of Chicago, giving the appearance of unbiased economic research and policy prescriptions. Hayek taught at the University of Chicago with prominent disciples like Milton Friedman, himself a Nobel Prize winner in economics in 1976. Now, I keep mentioning the Nobel Prize because neoliberalism in the 1940s and 50s was considered a kooky idea, right? Like far right-wing kind of thing. By the time you win two of your, best proponents win two Nobel Prizes, almost back-to-back, 74, 76, it's entered the mainstream, and it's become the new orthodoxy in terms of theory, right? In terms of economic theory, it has supplanted Keynesianism, which we'll talk about a little bit later again as a reminder, as a new economic orthodoxy, right? The intellectual often precedes the policy. They taught that capitalism was not functioning as it should due to state intervention, government intervention. They were convinced that the corporation's charter to maximize profits will naturally squeeze out inefficiencies, whereas governments are by nature a compromise of competing interests and are thus rife with waste, corruption, and overregulation. All right. Is it sinking in? How can we make it sink in better?
All right, so it sounds good.
Does it?
Yeah, it sounds good the way it's written here.
Okay.
You could read that out of a textbook or a journal and you can say, well, it makes all sense in the world, all the sense in the world. But the line, convince corporations charter to maximize profits will naturally squeeze out inefficiencies. Today that means get rid of companies of 300 or 400 employees at the same time without batting an eye.
Mm-hmm.
And the better you are at doing that, the more successful you'll be.
Right.
So we've got to deregulate it even more.
Right. So there is truth to this, that when you're aiming for the maximization of profits, you do want to squeeze out inefficiencies, right, to maximize profits. But what they don't tell us is that all of our efficiencies in working harder and harder and being more productive and efficient, all of the profit from that goes to the top, and they don't share it back with us. It's not like we get raises or we get better benefits or we get longer vacation. The super rich keep all that. And then they do crazy stuff with it, like buy islands and politicians and buy, you know, new regulations or deregulations so that they make even more profit. So that's the problem, is that there is some, I mean, and that's not all true either. It's not always like they get more efficient. But they don't share the benefits of that efficiency.
It worked better in the 40s to 70s than it did in the 80s. That's when you saw the escalation of the very top executives getting paid a lot.
Right.
So at the time when they got the PhDs, it was kind of working where people would get paid their marginal product, which is what the theory says. But so it kind of worked better before until they started to actually supposedly practice it.
And we're going to get there historically, so thank you for setting us up. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just wondering, what was the motivation behind what was his self-interest in, like, I mean, promoting this idea? And did that have anything to do with the political, economical climate of the day, which was around the end of World War II?
Hayek's primary concern was about a kind of a slavery, or whether through fascism or totalitarian communism that people would go into. So Germany and Russia, to Hayek, were object lessons. That if we have too much government intervention in our economic life, it basically leads to control of people's lives. And so individualism, so he was a hardcore individualist. He believed that maximum individual freedom, including corporations, to act as an individual too in society, was actually the best defense against state control.
So, in other words, reaction to trauma.
Yes, of course.
He's also an aristocrat too.
Yeah, he came from a very aristocratic family. All right, let's continue. We will define capitalism again here as a refresher, for it is the foundation of neoliberal economics. This is more a psychological story of capitalism. Capitalism assumes that the government's job is twofold. On the home front, to get out of the way for corporate ownership of public goods and services, right? In other words, privatization. To maximize consumer choice and meritorious distribution of wealth. Abroad, the government was to force open, or at least intimidate, manipulate foreign countries for both resource extraction and to generate consumer demand for market expansion. In our view, capitalism functions as if resources like oil, water, timber, iron ore, etc. are inexhaustible, and in any case, should be extracted to exhaustion. Capitalism assumes a psychology of deprivation and dissatisfaction at the individual level that generates permanent demand. Like, we're never happy with what we have. We always want the new and improved thing. Harnessed further through marketing. The most basic definition of marketing is getting people to want something they don't need. Right? That's the basic definition of marketing. I learned that definition in my own marketing class in college. And it became a science for real in the 1960s. Capitalism assumes a survival of the fittest, brutal efficiency, that the brutally efficient rich will become richer, and the uncompetitive poor should become even poorer and eventually die as nature takes its course, right? You can't compete, you should die. I mean, one of the reasons why the right is as hardcore as they are is because they understand nature in a certain way. Like, those of us in this church are really trying to move toward nature. But, yes, there is, you know, survival of the fittest to some degree, but there's also a tremendous amount of cooperation in nature. But according to these hardcore capitalists, nature is only brutal and brutally efficient, and everyone is basically dog-eat-dog, so to speak. So they believe that if people can't compete in the open market, then you shouldn't have anything. And if you're, you know, homeless and poor and hungry, then you should just eventually die. So those who have more, they should have even more because they deserve it. And those who have less because they can't compete, then they should just kind of, you know, quietly die and not make us think about it, so that society can keep evolving with the very best and brightest, right? The most competitive, the most vicious even, but whoever, you know, has the best means to survive. All right, one major obstacle to this vision was the rise of the Soviet Union as a power post-World War II. Communism was seen as a viable alternative for those nations burned once too often by the free market capitalism. The Cold War, roughly from 1945 to 1991, was a contest in which the U.S. and USSR each tried to contain the other to its existing sphere of influence and markets. The U.S. government and American multinational corporations colluded to cast communism as a mortal threat by conflating the Soviet Union's communist economy with their totalitarian rule. This had the magical effect of making exploitative corporations seem like the good guys compared to totalitarian Soviet communism, right? By the way, anybody appreciate the alliteration of the second to last sentence? Isaac and I had a really good laugh reading this out loud last night. Corporations colluded to cast communism, conflating communism. Okay, anyway. Regardless of their ideology, the upshot of both capitalism and communism was to plunder the earth and to pollute it without real cost due to lax government regulation and or corruption, buying off officials to look the other way. That meant that the global south was going to get screwed by either system, capitalism or communism, from colonial rule to neocolonial exploitation, basically out of the frying pan and into the fire. All right. How are we feeling here? Keith?
So the general thought was we knew all along how modest things were in the Russian economy and colluded basically to make them look like a bigger threat than they were.
There were economic statistics that showed they had a much more modest economy than they were portraying to see. And we obscured that so we could keep on boosting our military.
Economically, really, there was one economic superpower, and that was the U.S. post-World War II. But the Soviet Union was a nuclear superpower, and they actually, in the 60s and 70s, actually throughout, consistently had more nuclear weapons, warheads, than we did. So it was kind of a mortal threat. That's what the Soviet Union represented, an end to our way of life, our capitalist way of life. So the capitalist ideology, and especially in its neoliberal form, and social Darwinism go hand in hand. There is a sense that not only should the fittest survive, but the fittest should be rewarded. And not only should the unfit not survive, they should also be punished and put out of their misery as soon as possible. See that?
Just interesting to me in more recent conversations about globalism and offshoring and how everything at least domestic. But with this ideology, it's like, well, if you can't compete and they can make it better there, cheaper there, You should just go out of business. So I don't know, it's a conflicting sort of a, maybe I'm comparing big picture and big picture.
Well, right. So first, we offshore our jobs to cheaper labor somewhere else. And then we're supposed to move up the food chain and do higher level work rather than like with our hands, you know, with our minds kind of thing. And that's why college education is so important. And then now so many people have college education. Now we have to have higher degrees to keep advancing. But the thing is that we're very fast headed to a time when artificial intelligence... What in the world... we're fast headed to a time when even those of us who are highly educated can be replaced by artificial intelligence. So what do we do with, you know, countless human beings without a job? And if we cut the ability to get some kind of support, you know, in lean times, then, I mean, we're just going to be all homeless together? That's just a call for revolution then. You know, a very few people who control the industrial process, manufacturing and jobs, you know, hoarding all the wealth that they're not sharing, basically. So if we what I'm saying is, if we believe that the fittest should not only survive but thrive, and the rest of us be left to die, that group gets smaller and smaller over time. You see what I'm saying? So white people used to be told that we're part of that group, that we all, as white people, get to survive and thrive at the expense of black and brown people. But Trump rode the grievance of white working class and poor people, rode that grievance to power by saying, you know what, that promise was broken, and I'm going to restore that promise. I'm going to make America great again, meaning poor white people are going to get their share again, right? Which is a complete lie. But he did tap into a truth that what white people were told, that we were part of that, you know, fittest. The unofficial ruling class together, that the spoils on the top will be shared at least with white people, you know, has not come to pass in the last few years, if not decades. Right. So when a whole bunch more white people get it, that it's really not white versus non-white, it's the few elite, the capitalist class versus the rest of us, then I think some real change can happen. But what we've seen is, even for white people who've been dispossessed, who've been screwed over, they are basically not blaming this capitalist class. They're blaming Mexicans. Like, are you serious? You know, like, that's...
Yeah.
Well, that's why we're doing this class, you know? Because we are a nation of morons. Okay, Susie.
Okay, so...
I'm sorry, I shouldn't have.
Yeah, morons. Okay.
Please represent.
As a white person, okay, so the extreme capitalist ideology that you were talking about, that the dog-eat-dog, survival of the fittest, everybody else hurry up and die,
mm-hmm.
carried out to its logical conclusion is Hitler.
Hmm, wow.
No.
And death panels, and eliminating the undesirables of society, the people who cannot contribute or function, the non-ableist.
Yeah.
The elderly.
Interesting that eugenics has been a very powerful strain in American sociology.
He did distribute a lot of wealth, too.
Not to anybody who wasn't able to contribute to the German society.
Right. Well, yeah, that's one angle.
There are different versions of the same sentence in a lot of ways.
Mm.
This is the way I look at it. You know, communism... as extreme is very brutal. Fascism at its extreme is very brutal. Capitalism at its extreme is very brutal. It's
right.
All about it's at its extremes and allowed to run unchecked where the real issues seem to creep up.
Right.
The German welfare state was not pure capitalism.
Absolutely.
Well, that's why it's called National Socialism.
Yeah, so I'm saying,
right.
As a socialism.
Right. So, but let's leave that there for a second and remind ourselves that only now are many of us understanding that that democracy and capitalism don't necessarily go together. They're not like one package. You know, capitalism, we saw capitalism basically married to Pinochet and the dictators in Korea and Taiwan and other places. I mean, capitalism can go very well with totalitarianism. But in America, we propagandized capitalism as part and parcel of democracy, right? But then we did the opposite with communism. We said, look at Soviet Union. Communism and totalitarianism are one package. So, and it was. That's the thing, you know, Alexander Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago is a great chronicle of that. So we took one country that, because of the nuclear threat, was a mortal enemy, And we saw that in that country, totalitarianism and communism went hand in hand. And so we easily bought the propaganda that democracy, American-style democracy and American-style capitalism were also one package. And this is how corporations become the good guy, right? And how so many of us are fooled in thinking that playing along with the corporate elite is actually a patriotic duty. Someone had their hand up here. Lori.
But it's a little bit off. I mean, so as I read this, like, I still am having my struggle wrapping my head around it, but I think part of it is because it's all, like, assumptions or conclusions. Well, if, then, and then if that happens, then this, and this, and it's like, we're creating all this stuff that people are affected by all these assumptions that we don't actually know will, like, fall into that place or not, because like you just listed, there's all these other aspects that, like democracy or totalitarian, you know, that come into play that that change that. And I guess that's why it's so hard to follow, is because it's just all these assumptions.
So by their fruits ye shall know them. Not assumptions, not economic theory, by their fruits. So now we can actually go through history and see the fruit of Keynesianism and then see the fruit of neoliberalism, right? Yeah, pretty much. Now we're going to actually see it in action. Okay, let's move to one, the dust settles. This is the dust of war. In the aftermath of the Second World War, the U.S. began to cobble together a global empire through what was known as the Grand Strategy. Unlike more conventionally obvious empires like France and Great Britain, the U.S. embarked on a strategy of plausible deniability, to market democracy, freedom, and human rights to obscure America's more sinister imperial ambitions. So we talked about this last week, that the United States is a very strange empire. It functions exactly like every other empire, but continues to deny that it is, and offers up plausible deniability, right? Because we don't actually occupy nations with a military force. And then we don't even... We try to obscure the fact that we're colonial masters to Puerto Rico. Like, what is Puerto Rico, you know? Or Guam, or the U.S. Virgin Islands, or Alaska, or all of what used to be Mexico, from Texas to California, or Hawaii. But we pretend that we're such a great nation that these people threw themselves at us. Can we please be a part of American democracy? That's the story we tell ourselves. So, what happened? Bretton Woods. Bretton Woods is a little resort town in New Hampshire. And I would like to vacation there. Yes. The U.S. and Great Britain were the primary architects. Basically, FDR and... who's the other guy? Winston Churchill. Of the post-World War II economic order. In 1944, some 44 nations gathered in New Hampshire to create the International Monetary Fund and what would be known as the World Bank. The U.S. has effectively controlled these two institutions, dominating global commerce to this day. The IMF makes short-term loans to countries in crisis, which, by the way, the U.S. often puts into crisis, right, to then bail them out. And the World Bank funds aggressive infrastructure investments, basically loading developing nations with massive debt that favors Western lender nations. So, example. Would an example help? So, the U.S. government, through its State Department, remember the State Department is our Commerce Department, goes to some country in Latin America or in Asia or in Africa and says, you need an airport. They're like, why? You know, we just drive to another country and we fly out of there. Yeah, but if you had an airport, then we can build bridges and roads and develop businesses and then you become wealthy. And if you allow us to build this airport and then roads that lead to it and all kinds of other infrastructure, then we'll make sure that you as the ruler get a cut. You know, and that cut could be in the billions of dollars. So massive, you know, sometimes hundreds of billions of dollars come into a country and the ruling party or the ruling despot might get half a billion, couple of billion dollars. Suharto in Indonesia amassed billions and billions of dollars in his decades-long rule of Indonesia, right? Getting cuts like this from these massive infrastructure projects. So they'll build an airport that hardly anybody uses, and they'll build roads that hardly anybody uses. But they have all this infrastructure that's actually over time crumbling. But all the multinational corporations, especially in the U.S., got paid building that. And then now they get paid by what money? Money that was loaned to the country, but all that money, some of the money got siphoned off to the ruling elite, but most of that money went to Western multinational corporations. Now that country is saddled with billions of dollars of debt with high interest rates that they have to pay the IMF or World Bank back. And then when people realize that their leaders screwed them over, there could be a revolution, or they could run away with all their billions of the Swiss bank account somewhere else. And then now it's the next government's problem. So even when governments are trying to do the right thing, the previous government could have screwed over the whole country because of these deals. And these Western institutions consistently for decades now have screwed over the people by making sweetheart deals with the ruling elite, indebting and impoverishing the whole country over infrastructure projects that actually are like bridges to nowhere, right? And then these countries endlessly owe these Western institutions, decade after decade, and they can't ever invest in real things like healthcare, education, job training, developing and owning their own industries out of their own natural resources, because they have so much debt to pay back to these international lending and infrastructure organizations. Does that make sense?
You know, this was very telling, the 80s, what's called the lost decade for Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
But was it also like that in the 50s, 60s, and 70s?
More of a drift towards that direction? Yes, it was. That's a great question. Was this process that I was talking about happening in the 50s, 60s, 70s? Yes, it was. But in the 80s, turbocharged. And that's why in the 80s, we have the Latin American debt crisis. It was even called the Latin American debt crisis because we did that trick with so many Latin American countries. But we were doing that trick all over the world, by the way. We had what some call economic hitmen go into countries and set all this up and say, okay, we will siphon off $30 million to you and your cronies, okay? If you take out the loan on behalf of the government and take out a $5 billion loan and let Western companies come in and build all this stuff. And some of them's like, no, we don't want that. You know, this is a trick. We saw you do that to our neighboring country. We're not going to do that. Oh, okay. You're really putting your foot down. You're not going to do that? All right, well then, I've made my case. Now I'm going to leave, and other people will come in my way, come your way, and they will be actually working for the CIA. I just work for the State Department, right? But now that you're not going to listen to me, CIA will send in their hitmen, and of course they deny, plausible deniability, that they are related to any U.S. government. But they'll basically then come and say, okay, now we're playing hardball. You either take the $30 million or there's going to be a coup d'etat and you will no longer be the ruler of this country and we can make it happen just like that. So then they might, and then if they resign, like, where are you going to run away to, right? So usually they take the money either through corruption or through coercion. But this is well documented all over the world. And the U.S. government was directly doing this all over the world, this level of corrupting officials or coercing them with a threat of a coup or even assassinations. How many world leaders who were opposed to U.S. policy died in plane crashes? Just look that up, right? How many world leaders died in plane crashes? Lori?
So what was the justification, and then what was the benefit to doing this?
Justification for what?
Well, so, like, how did they get away with this? Like, what were they saying was their justification for going into these countries and doing this?
These countries used to be called third world countries, right?
Right.
And then we renamed them developing countries. To develop them, of course, so that they have airports and roads and all the modern trappings of Western capitalist states, so that they can, you know, rise to the same level as us. So one is, yes, creating capitalist allies as a bulwark against Soviet expansion. But the other was to expand our own markets. If they participate in capitalism, first of all, they'll owe money, so they'll be paying rent and loans and all that, but also they'll have to participate more and more in the capitalist economy just to earn the hard currency to pay us back.
And they can't subsidize their domestic industries as well if they're deeply indebted. That's something
right.
That's hard to do if you have to pay off your debts. And they're with really high interest rates.
I'll take the two questions back there. But just to add to that, what we can do, and we mentioned this in the first class, that other nations cannot do, is we can pay back loans with money that we print. And if anybody says, hey, you're printing fake money, we're not going to take that, we have military bases, nuclear weapons, every kind of weapon imaginable to say, no, you better take it, or we'll take you out. So, Germany, after World War I, owed so much money to the victor nations through the Treaty of Versailles that they began to just print money. And it became worthless because everybody knew it was just paper. So people had wheelbarrows full of money, right? They couldn't buy a loaf of bread, as we said. So similarly, these countries cannot print money to actually bail themselves out the way the U.S. can, because no one will take, like, South Korea printing money, you know? Who's going to take Korean won when they're in crisis? No, the U.S. is going to say, you have a crisis in 1997, the IMF crisis. You need to pay us back in U.S. dollars. Okay? You see the difference? So nobody can print U.S. dollars except the U.S. So when Korea's in crisis, when Guatemala is in crisis, when Kenya is in crisis, they have to pay us, they have to take a loan to immediately deal with their crisis, then they have to pay us back in U.S. dollars. That means they have to participate in our neoliberal economic system so they can earn hard currency, meaning U.S. dollars, to pay us back. But when we're in crisis, we can print U.S. dollars at will through the Federal Reserve Board, who just orders the mint to print however much money we want. So we're almost $20 trillion in debt, $20 trillion. That no one can ever call, you know, they can't collect because of our military power, and also because we're in a new economic mad. Throughout the Cold War, the U.S. and the USSR were in a military and political mad, mutual assured destruction. You launch nuclear weapons at us, we launch it at you, and we're both completely destroyed. The U.S. and China are in a similar mad, but economically. China wants to collect the trillions of dollars in U.S. bonds, treasury loans that they've taken out. They actually want to collect on that. And then we say, okay, we'll just pay you all this fake money. Then our economy collapses and their economy collapses because most of their economy is based on exports to the U.S. and U.S. allies, right? So we actually, if they actually demanded to collect on the debt, we would... Both economies would be destroyed. So they're going to pretend like we owe them real money, and we're going to pretend like we're going to pay them real money. But all of that is just fake, right? So MAD is still the operative logic just now in the economic sphere. Bobby Tope?
Yes, sir. I just wanted to speak to what happened in the 60s in Africa.
Okay.
With respect to United States. So what actually happened was actually through some sort of a duplicitous means. So they didn't, I mean, it wasn't really through lending loans, because that was when Africa began to get independent. Ghana got our independence in 1957. Nigeria got our independence in 1960. So the 1960 was actually declared as the year of Africa. So United States came to Africa and kind of met with all the African leaders, and we're really passionate. We love everything that's going with you guys, and I think African leaders were able to receive them, because all these countries, with the exception of Liberia, were not colonized by the United States, colonized by the British. So they kind of saw them as, these are allies coming in, and even though Dr. King and Malcolm X were coming to Africa to warn African leaders, you got to be careful of these guys, they don't do well for you. So basically the arrangement was, we in the area of, you guys have resources, so in the areas where you have comparative advantage, so the fact that you're not technologically advanced, we are. So we buy from you,
Like raw materials.
Raw materials. we produce it, so
that's right.
An agreement in such a way that when we bring it back, yeah. come buy it from us.
Right.
But it didn't follow through on that.
No.
On that. So it was just coming, you know, stealing and not in such a way that they're bankrupt everywhere and having to do with it. And that was kind of the era where subsidies were given to, you know, farmers in the United States in such a way that even areas like Burkina Faso, the United States actually gave them for $3 million loan, but just because of the subsidies that were given to and the comparative advantage that they had was in the area of cotton. Mm-hmm. But cotton, you know, was highly subsidized there in such a way that they lost $200 million.
Yeah. So as they say, by hook or by crook. This is a really important thing that Baba Tope talks about. In the 50s and 60s and 70s, African nations especially were gaining independence from their colonial masters, namely France, Great Britain, Germany, Portugal. And as that happened, the West was losing free resources, right? If you're a colony, you just take whatever you want. And also losing a captive market. So you just take the resources there, and then you sell them whatever you want. And because it's a colony, you don't let them buy from other countries. You buy directly from us. But now that they're free, they can do whatever they want. So then the West goes in with its Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank and IMF, and gives them loans for development. And it's basically the same thing that happened to many of us with student loans. You know, what does an 18-year-old know about what $10,000 is worth, right? And what do newly independent countries know what structural adjustment is and all these economic terms? And they're like, hey, here's a free money to help build whatever you need. They're like, okay, that sounds good. You know, so some of it was by hook and some of it was by crook, by coercion, threatening coup d'etats. And either way, we basically, this is what is known as neocolonialism. So they come out of direct colonialism, and then they move into debt slavery, right? From slavery to debt slavery. And this is what capitalism does, and it's done that to all of us, too, a whole bunch of us, where by the time we're 22, we're looking at paying off loans for the next 20 years. That's called indentured service, right? If you know history, that is the definition of indentured servitude. And that's how we replicate slavery in the capitalist system through the instrument of debt. Jordan.
My question's already answered.
Oh, good. All right, should we proceed to the Cold War? The Soviet Union and the U.S. were the only military superpowers left intact after the devastation of World War II. Once Nazi Germany and its allies were defeated, the U.S. in 1949 formed NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, as a bulwark against the USSR. In response, Moscow created the Warsaw Pact in 1955 to make Eastern Europe a buffer against NATO. Truman's National Security Act of 1947 created the Department of Defense and the CIA as permanent war machines. Newly independent nations were caught in a bipolar world in which friendship or economic relations with one side meant inviting the wrath of the other, either the U.S. or the USSR, including being hit with trade embargoes, sabotage, and even military invasion. Only nations of the non-aligned movement retained their sovereignty and neutrality. So this Cold War is in the background. And so some of, you know, American actions are genuinely out of fear of a war with the Soviet Union. And a lot of it was playing on that fear, right? So some of it was real fear, and a lot of it was playing on that fear. So we see the dark blue is NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Alliance, Treaty Organization, and then the dark red is the Warsaw Pact, because they... there was a Soviet Union just made it happen, but they met in Warsaw. And then these are socialist aligned, so they're kind of aligned with the Soviet Union, these lighter red. The gray is the non-aligned. They can declare neutrality and saying we're not going to, you know, be aligned with either group. Wait, what is this light blue? Oh, allies of the United States. This blue is allies of the United States. So look at huge non-aligned countries like India, China, Egypt. I mean, Sudan is big, but not strategically that important, but Egypt was. So there are major non-aligned nations that the U.S. and the USSR are constantly in conflict with in order to kind of co-opt into one power sphere or another. All right, let's press forward with two at least. The complicated age of social democracy, 1950 to 68. For several decades, white Americans enjoyed the privileges of living in a prosperous global empire. Remember, we said that the U.S. was basically the only economic superpower post-World War II because its industries were the only ones that were unmolested through World War II. While minorities waited for their share of the wealth, which had been promised to them in exchange for their participation in the world wars, you know, fighting our battles, basically, the middle class, white middle class, experienced dramatic increases in wages and standard of living. So the corporations did share some of their productivity gains with labor up to the late 60s. But starting with the 70s, all productivity gains were kept by the capitalist class. That's why there's been, so wages have been stagnant relative to inflation, right? If wages rise at the same rate of inflation, that means you're getting no increase, right? So relative to inflation, our wages have been completely stagnant since the early 70s. Early 70s. From my sources, early 80s, from another source. All right? But household income has risen dramatically. Why? Because of entry of women in the workforce. Now, in the 60s and 70s, women were making about 55 to 60 cents on the dollar. Women now make about 80 cents on the dollar to a comparable man. So in the 70s and 80s, that means that if you have two full-time workers, you've increased your household income by 1.6 times. You see what I'm saying? So that means 1.6 times the house, education for your children, cars, you know, furniture, whatever. So it looked like Americans were prospering, but that's because our social arrangement changed dramatically and we moved to two household incomes rather than one. But that also meant incredibly much higher levels of stress, which also we see the flat wages leading people to dual income, which then makes our divorce rate skyrocket.
So the cost of daycare can oftentimes cancel out that income.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there was inflation means that some things are. Something inflation is different. So it looks like in healthcare, inflation really skyrocketed compared to other things. So yes, it's been tough. It has been tough for the average American worker, whether they are blue collar or white collar, but especially blue collar, and the less highly paid professions like teaching or healthcare, like nurses, basically. You know, since the 70s, it's been really tough. All right, so what are a couple of things that are happening in this time? Keynesianism and the affluent society, A. British economist John Maynard Keynes observed that the only way to keep capitalism stable was to strategically stimulate the economy through heavy government spending during recessions and downturns. The economy often went like this, like a roller coaster. And it was painful, and it meant a great disruption to the business world. So look, highest standard of living in the world, the American. There's a picture of the American dream. Those kids should put on their seatbelts. Right? From the dawn of Roosevelt's New Deal to the mid-1970s, Keynesianism was regarded as gospel truth. Through an expanding public sector, meaning government spending, and a progressive income tax, top earners paid a 91% tax rate in the 1950s. The elimination of poverty and unemployment for white citizens seemed possible, within reach. Consumerism, or the notion that heavy and consistent consumption of goods and services by the average person would be the primary vehicle for growth, became the cornerstone of economic policy. So now, not mercantilism, which is still where China is, like selling your goods abroad and bringing in that profit, right? Now our own domestic consumption became the linchpin of our economic strategy. So Keynesianism means, so here's what happens. I think we explained this before, but it might be worth saying this again. If I think that, you know, my company is struggling and I might lose my job maybe 3-4 months from now, then I'm not going to upgrade my car like I was thinking about upgrading, right? And we've already fixed the refrigerator 3 times. Maybe we should get a new refrigerator. But maybe if I'm going to lose my job, I might have to just repair it a 4th time instead of buying a brand new refrigerator. If I repair the refrigerator, I pay the repair person, and there's a little bit of economic stimulus through that, right? That person gets money, and then that person spends it. But if I buy a whole new refrigerator, remember the ripple effect of major appliances and products? That stimulates the economy way more. So at the micro level, meaning at the individual level, if I think that I might lose my job, I'm going to save the money instead of consuming, instead of spending that money. So then I'm part of the problem. I help depress economic activity and therefore prevent economic growth. Now, if a whole bunch of us think that our jobs are kind of iffy, or prices are going up really high, inflation, like gas prices are climbing really fast, and we need to save more money than spend it, and we stop buying, we stop consuming, then collectively we are depressing the whole economic activity of a nation. So when that starts happening, the government can step in and create a stimulus, which means release a whole bunch of cash to in whatever way it wants. Like in Bush Jr. sending a whole bunch of us $1,200 checks, right? And telling us to go and spend. Or a tax cut for the wealthy, or a tax cut for the poor, or a child tax credit. If you have children, you give less money to the government, which means you keep more, and then you're probably going to spend it. So there are many, many ways to just basically pump cash into people and hope that they spend it, which will create economic activity that then gets jobs going and GDP to grow, economic activity to grow. Are you listening to me? Does that make sense? Look at me. So basically, here's what I'm trying to say. Personal responsibility is not good for macroeconomic health, right? From the government's point of view, once we go off the mercantile route, meaning, you know, exports-driven economy, to domestic consumption route, then we have to keep spending if we're patriotic and want our economy to keep growing and be healthy. Even if that means personal debt, even if we take out loans through credit card and other things that we can't afford, just spending creates so much economic activity, production-consumption cycle, that overall it grows. Now, if like up to the 70s, part of that growth and wealth were shared with the working class, that's one thing. But especially through neoliberalism, hardly any of it is shared with us. All of that stimulated profits basically rises to the top and stays there, and it's not reinvested back into the economy like they're supposed to do, like they say they're supposed to do. They just keep it, basically. And so it ultimately has a short-term stimulative effect, but long-term, we enter into recessions just like under Keynesianism, and that's what we'll see very quickly. Isaac?
Basically, like when the government just makes up money and gives it to people to spend and buy things, that's kind of an illusion of prosperity. They're creating a feeling that times are good and it's going to be better next year because we just got this big check, which actually, in reality, makes the economy better the next year. It can work for a short amount of time. Because you buying actually, in reality, makes the other person's job more secure. And then they will, in turn, go and spend their money somewhere else. And in a whole society, it will lift the economy. But that can only work for a short amount of
time.
And if it is allowed to seep into households, where people can feel the effects of the prosperity.
Mm-hmm. So the money is, that kind of government stimulus is maximized when the money goes to poor people. Because as we said last week, poor people have to spend it all. But when you give it to rich people, they'll save it. And once we squirrel it away, it's generating no economic activity, just sitting there in the bank. Susie.
Yeah, so like if you get an economic stimulus check, you should probably put it in your savings account. It's going
to
tank, right?
Oh, well, you're speaking like a bad American there, once again. Yeah. Don't listen to her. David.
I'd say workfare is unstable, especially when it comes to
what?
Workfare. Which is what is often associated with Keynesianism, you know, where we're trying to boost the economy to keep the jobs going. But that's unstable, especially with respect to, like you mentioned, goods that last a long time. And you can potentially stretch out its use for a little bit longer if you have to.
Right.
It only kind of worked before because the ups and downs were heavily concentrated among minorities.
Mm.
For example, the unemployment rate has traditionally been twice as big for African Americans as it has been for white people.
Mm-hmm.
So by concentrating the ups and downs, the damage on minorities, you were able to maintain the semblance of stability for white people.
Stable white working class.
Right. That's good. Now, by using the black population as the flexible workforce.
Oh, yeah.
That's great. All right. Let's talk about McCarthyism a little bit. There was a Joseph McCarthy and a Eugene McCarthy. They're different people. Joseph McCarthy was a radical right-wing anti-communist nutjob. Eugene McCarthy was a senator from Minnesota that was progressive and actually ran for president. Anyway, Russia's nuclear test in 1949 meant that Russia had nuclear weapons, right? They caught up to us. And then Mao's communist revolution in China, same year, and the Korean War, 50 to 53, were perceived by the West as an orchestrated move toward communist hegemony. Hegemony means total global takeover. Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin, hello, Wisconsin, what is up with you guys? You know, from then to this day, get your act together. Stop ruining the whole nation, please. Ah, there. I got it out there.
Wasn't Joe McCarthy subsidized by Joe Kennedy?
Possibly. All right. So McCarthy exploited these events, real events, but claimed that communists were infiltrating the highest levels of the federal government. He claimed that there were 200 hardcore communists working for the State Department. It was a complete fabrication, but that's what got all these Senate hearings going. At the same time, the Pentagon worked closely with defense contractors, meaning corporations, to build a massive nuclear arsenal and delivery systems, missiles, to contain communism. There's that word containment again. In his last days as president, Eisenhower warned, who himself was a military general, warned of the growing danger of the military-industrial complex. One of the last great things that he did as a service to the nation. Yes, Brian.
So, would you care to speculate on how Joseph McCarthy would respond to the fact that just the other day we had Russians in the Oval Office?
Well, I'll just leave your comment in the air.
Tommy?
Can you tell me a little bit more about the purpose behind, inflating the threat? Because it seems like it's at least twofold. One, to build up the military as an excuse to continue to build the military, and then two, to suppress the socialist activity at home. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And that's what we're going to talk about next. So did you all hear Laura? One of the rationale for talking up the Red Menace, as it was called, was that you basically dramatically increased military spending. You know, what does that mean? That means huge amounts of money to corporations that sell to our Defense Department, right? So this is a great business if you're in the war business. Major defense contractors today would be Northrop Grumman, Honeywell, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Boeing. Boeing is interesting because they're in, you know, they're in domestic corporate stuff and military stuff.
I think Stalinsky referred to the Red Scare as like a Holocaust for activists.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They forced them to basically go underground, or they at least ended their activism.
Right. And the other reason for the Red Scare was to suppress dissent and to intimidate and threaten activists who are actually trying to fight for democracy in this time. So anti-communism was just a way for those in charge to suppress dissent. Dana?
I'm just curious how many people in this room had financial stability in their family directly as a result of this. And I know I'm definitely, you know, like, but I know I'm not the only one. I just thought that, right? Like, there's got to be at least 5 or 6 of us.
Yeah.
Families found.
I see at least 6 right now.
Just to make it, like, real in this. Oh, yeah, Jinsu. He's an aerospace engineer.
Not only me, but I mean, my father was my a civil engineering contractor.
Right?
Yeah. Wrote on the wave of all those deaths. Yeah.
That, yeah.
There's almost 10 of us who've raised our hand just now.
I thought it kind of makes it come yeah. for us right here, like, you know, in the military.
Yeah. Yeah. See? We have found the enemy, and it is us.
Amen.
All right. Oh, man. We're just getting going. Should we take a break? Oh, okay, break. 5 minutes. All right. Look at me.
Hello.
Yes.
Look at me. It's a Koreanism. What can I say? Okay. So, Part 3, stagflation, strange word, dissent, and backlash. Thank you. Keynesian theory began to fall apart as wartime deficit spending in Vietnam proved to be unsustainable, nearly bankrupting the U.S. Treasury. Remember what I think Isaac said? The Keynesian stimulus is supposed to just get us going, you know, get the spigot to turn on. And then we're supposed to do the rest by actually spending and stimulating the economy ourselves, right? But prolonged war, the Vietnam War lasts 20 years, technically, but there's heavy combat for about like 8 to 10 years, like serious combat, massive amounts of military spending that has to be covered by debt, deficit spending. So, that, I mean, there was a lot of stimulus, of course, because of that. But short-term, long-term, and the U.S. economy just could not recover. The American economy itself was not able to catch up to that level of deficit spending. And then another thing happened. The predominantly Arab OPEC, not exclusively, Venezuela was part of OPEC too, Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, began an oil embargo in 1973, that spiked global gas prices and brought the American economy to its knees. How many of you, only a few, how many of us were alive when people stood in lines that lasted 2 to 4 hours long to get gas? Okay? Or, okay, in the United States?
What range of years?
1973, 74, right? How many of us have seen TV footage of these super long lines? Okay, good. We have some informed people here. Praise the Lord. And people would, you know, people would like park the car on the street, and then they'd have to push it because they ran out of gas waiting for people, you know, and then they'd get to the gas station and they'd be out of gas. And then they had to pay sometimes 4 times what they were paying just the month before. So it really showed Americans, the average American, that the U.S. was actually not the dominant power that we thought we were. And that little tiny, you know, like, this is a kind of a common thing that an American would say. You know, a tiny country with people wearing turbans on their head get to control, you know, how we live the American way of life, you know, that kind of stuff. So, yeah, these are the kind of signs. What do they say? Rags, wearing rags on their head. Thank you. I mean, no thanks.
Sand Negroes.
So they had these signs. It was the government going almost bankrupt through war, and then consumers going bankrupt and without fuel for transportation and basic living. That combination and the rise in oil prices meant inflation, right? And wages were not keeping up with the spike in oil prices. It didn't just mean gas for cars. It also meant heating oil. It also meant the cost of operating a building. I mean, oil prices are in everything. Also plastics. You know, we make plastic with petroleum. So prices were spiking in every single sector of American economy, but wages remained flat because the war was a huge drag on the U.S. economy. So you have inflation and you have stagnation. That combined was called stagflation. According to the Keynesian economic model, there should be no such thing as stagflation. Like, stimulus should get the economy moving toward a healthy and stable rate of growth, right? Okay, so, where am I? A?
And maybe just say, like, why that's important right now. Because MEA will go into that, but what is opening the door for?
You're on civil rights movement. Next.
Well, sorry.
The reason that that's important is, as we'll get to later, is because now Keynesian economics aren't working. So Mont Pelerin is waiting in the wings to bring neoliberalism to the
board. Right. So Keynesianism basically collapsed. That idea collapsed in the 70s with stagflation, and the U.S. Government could not seem to get us out of this deadly combination of economic stagnation and high persistent inflation. Okay? Thank you. All right. So, stagflation, a combination of stagnant wages and price inflation, became the primary scourge that crippled the economy of the 1970s. During the hard years of the 60s and 70s, Americans lost much of what they felt made America great. A healthy, growing economy, confidence in their democracy, military dominance, and a positive self-image as a virtuous nation on the right side of history, right? Unlike the Soviet Union, which was the opposite of all these things, according to the American imagination. However, the Civil Rights Movement challenged America's founding narratives and exposed the true face of Jim Crow racism. News reports of racist violence and police brutality in the U.S. left a strong and indelible impression worldwide, damaging American credibility as a free and democratic nation and potentially curbing our economic reach, right? Who wants to trade with an evil country like us? The Watergate scandal created profound distrust between the government and its citizens, particularly the younger generation who now wouldn't trust anyone over 30. That's a whole bunch of us here. The environmental movement called attention to the destructive impact of capitalism on the earth itself. Dissent was also expressed through the sexual revolution that was kicked off by the pill, the birth control pill. The feminist movement, the American Indian movement, gay rights, the anti-war movement, etc., many other movements. The illusion of American sovereignty seemed to last only as long as America got its way in the rest of the world, and that was happening less and less now in this time. In 1971, Nixon's Supreme Court appointee, Lewis Powell, is that him? Crafted a memorandum spelling out the threat posed by radical groups in America to the enterprise system, as he called it, and advocated a society-wide counter-revolution. Nixon's racist law and order platform, this is what they call a dog whistle, law and order meant put black people in jail, right? So Nixon was the first Republican since FDR time, since the early 1930s, to win the Southern vote, because that was a typically Democratic stronghold. But the Democrats voted in favor of the Civil Rights Movement, basically with the Northern Republicans. So that gave Nixon a chance to win Southern Democrats who were still racist, also known as Dixiecrats, right? So we used to have Southern racist Democrats, but all those Dixiecrats became Republican through Ronald Reagan and succeeding administrations, right? So there are basically no more Dixiecrats left because they all became Republican. So his law and order platform and his war on drugs scapegoated minorities, whom Powell called the most articulate, the most vocal, and the most prolific sources of resistance. Doesn't that sound like a description of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr.? Okay. Public funding for higher education, cast as a breeding ground for radicals, was slashed, leading to massive student debt that domesticated the student movements of the 1960s. Debt, right? Never forget that debt is the path to slavery. Okay? Never, as much as is possible, is humanly possible, go get into unsecured debt. That's like student loans, credit card loans, even car loans is almost like unsecured debt because you get so little if you ever want to sell a car you bought new, right? So basically, make friends, not debt. And community should, as much as possible, help to make each other's lives work. That's what the Christian church is about.
Can we just pause for a moment on that Powell memorandum?
Yes.
And maybe talk a little bit about what that was and what that was doing.
John, you want to speak to this a little bit? John did most research on Lewis Powell.
Yeah, well, I mean, you say here he is a Supreme Court appointee. This was addressed to the Chamber of Commerce.
Mm-hmm. To the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And it was basically corporate power has to be restored. And he's drawing from everything that had happened in the Mont Pelerin Society. A lot of that work that Friedman, Hayek, and all these guys have been, they've been formulating this economic philosophy, mm-hmm. but this was, it's time to go on the offensive.
That's right.
So with this, you start to get a whole bunch of think tanks. How do we take back the university because of all these student movements and seen as a breeding ground for all of this? They lump together everything under kind of these radical leftists, and then they connect that with communism and that scare and socialism. So all of these various movements, whether it's the civil rights movement or everything that we have listed here, it all gets lumped into a threat to corporations and profit. But he uses freedom, democracy, the American way of life, all of that sort of propagandistic language to describe the threat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you can read it online. I mean, it's like, 40 pages or so, and it's a pretty quick read. And this becomes the blueprint for the next 10 to 15 years for the neoliberal takeover, organizing and mobilizing people to do that work leading up to Reagan and Thatcher.
Mm-hmm. If you think about pro-democracy movements all over the world, it's often led by university students, right? Yeah. And if you think about the anti-war movement, feminist movement, all kinds of civil rights movement too, think about the power of SNCC, Student, Nonviolent Coordinating Committee of the civil rights movement. Students, you know, university students drove many of these most progressive movements. So this is not a small thing that Powell lays a blueprint for a counter-offensive against student movements of every kind. And so since the 60s, we've basically had a domesticated university population, unlike university students all the rest of the world, many of whom were inspired by our student movements here in the 60s, right? Very effective. Yes?
Because of the civil rights movement, in 1965, this country accepted colored people to be legally immigrants to this country.
Yes.
In 1965.
Yeah.
Before that, I mean, we were open country.
And Ms. Kim, what year did you come to this country?
I came here in Thanksgiving Day of 1970. And then I married to an ex-priest who I have to support him. So I was bartender in 1970s.
Bartender.
I support my family doing that. I was called by gooks, chicks. And it was pretty brutal around that time.
Yeah.
And go back home. And then my ex-mother-in-law was German background, very racist, blue-collar woman. When my aunt, my mom, came from Korea in 1973, she invited us to eat dinner at her house. However, she had an unexpected visitor, which was her brother and the wife and two kids. And actually, she put us in the kitchen.
Wow.
So we were eating at the kitchen. And they just gave the dinner and then give us a last. And, you know, I kind of got my aunt's personality. She's a very strong woman. And she, on the way back, she told me, I want you to be my interpreter too. Ask your husband, is this the way American people treat their in-laws?
Yeah.
Because Korean culture, they don't.
Right.
And then I said, I'm so disappointed by you, my son-in-law.
Wow.
That much was very, very recent. Until refugees came in the 80s and all that, we were very, very, yeah.
Yeah, so there's I think it's worth noting, since Ms. Kim brings this up, that there is legitimate resentment by the African American community toward new immigrants that came through the Immigration Reform Act of 1965, that opened up large scale immigration to non Europeans for the first time in American history, largely through the gains of the Civil Rights Movement, and yet. We come here and we test the wind and we see that all the power and privilege and wealth is with the white people, so then we try to pass ourselves off as off-white rather than be grateful to the civil rights movement and then link arms with those who have always been taken advantage by this society. So we're still, you know, working that out. And the Rodney King issue in 1992 was the explosion of that resentment and ignorance on the part of Korean people about our history.
Real
David, quick, yes.
The Southerners tried to kill the Civil Rights Amendment by bundling it with women's rights, and then when JFK was killed, that created the momentum to get both of them passed at the same time.
Interesting.
So it was the extension of rights to women was was an attempt to sabotage giving rights to blacks.
And my response to that is, ha ha. All right.
Why does the Voters' Rights Amendment fall in this? This is in the
70s. That's what I was referring to.
Well, the Civil Rights Act is 1964, and the Voting Rights Act is 1965. Mm-hmm.
1965 with the Voting Rights Act, that's when the final Native Americans got the right to vote.
Okay. And 65 is also the Immigration Reform Act that Ms. Kim was talking about. Right, so it's a couple of pivotal years. All right, let's proceed.
Just one quick thing about Powell.
Yes.
Before he was a Supreme Court Justice, he was a corporate lawyer for Phillips Morris. Philip Morris, yeah. And actively working against all the studies linking tobacco and cancer.
Philip Morris is Marlboro, right?
Yeah. It was a woman, Phyllis Morris.
All right. Part four, neoliberal power moves, 1973 to 80. The long battle between two economic schools, Keynesianism, as exemplified by FDR's New Deal, and neoliberalism, turned decisively in favor of neoliberalism in the late 1970s. Major political figures such as Pinochet, Thatcher, and Reagan emerged in the 70s to actualize major components of neoliberal economics. Deregulation, remember how we defined that, just less rules so corporations can make more money. And corporate tax cuts stimulated the economy, measured by gross domestic product and net growth, under the slogans trickle-down economics and a rising tide lifts all boats, if only. But in reality, the working class was exposed to the raw interests of Wall Street. What do we mean by Wall Street? We mean speculative capitalism, right? So gambling, as we said before, gambling with the profits made in the real economy, resulting in a capitalist dreamscape, high unemployment, and no governing body to limit the reach of their greed. That's a very poetic sentence by Isaac. Thank you, Isaac. Reagan's neoliberal economic... What in the world? Oh, we didn't finish that sentence. The coming decades would be dominated by the neoliberal agenda, Reaganomics. Oh, I didn't finish that.
Oh, that was you?
Yeah, sorry. But it could have been Isaac. I mean, come to think of it, I think it was Isaac. Yeah. All right.
That was
1:30. It's good to. Oh, see, it's good to be the senior pastor. Okay. Okay, so here's some examples, right, of key figures. Augusto Pinochet, there he is. Look how long and skinny Chile is. Wow. Yep. Just an observation that has no relevance to this class. In a military coup supported by the State Department and the CIA and local Chilean business elites, General Pinochet seized power from the democratically elected and very popular socialist government of Salvador Allende, who was killed in the struggle, assassinated. Pinochet began a sweeping campaign of state-sponsored terrorism against all opposition. By the late 1980s, 45% of the population had fallen into poverty, while the wealthiest 10% saw major income increases. Hello, welcome to America.
Yeah.
But he was held up as a hero.
Yes.
A neoliberal economist, because his whole package of policies was basically great for corporations, and the socialist government had been defeated.
Right.
He was a great capitalist.
Now, remember we were talking about the specter of Soviet Union? Okay. The reason why that is important is even if this guy is a brutal dictator and was plundering his own country and giving a massive bonus to the wealthy while impoverishing the poor, as a close right-wing ally of the United States, he was going to make sure that communism, or there wouldn't be zero Soviet influence in Chile, right? And if other countries emulated that, then you have a whole, then the Western Hemisphere can be safe for democracy against communism. Now, why is that important? Because of Cuba. So they actually did something. We did have an incident here that we didn't, well, we did mention here very briefly, 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, where Khrushchev, the premier of the Soviet Union, sent nuclear warheads to Cuba to be able to, you know, at least threaten us from close range. Cuba is only 90 miles from Key West, 90 miles from U.S. territory. Through a lot of complicated negotiations, Kennedy was able to get those missiles returned to the Soviet Union and averted the closest we ever got to direct nuclear war with the Soviet Union. So there was, as I said, real threats, but also threats that we played up for other gains. So because of the Cuban Missile Crisis and because of this ongoing nuclear proliferation and contest between these two great powers, politicians and corporate leaders were able to say, hey, Pinochet is a dirty SOB, but he's our SOB. And at least as brutal as he is and as exploitative as he is and as corrupt as he is, at least he's keeping the Soviet Union out of our backyard. See the logic? You know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
I think it's worth noting here, too, that the U.S., the University of Chicago, was mentioned several times.
Oh, yes.
Has been training Chilean economists. The U.S. government had been bringing them here to train them at the University of Chicago in the, I think it was in the late 70s.
This guy was a disciple of Milton Friedman.
Yeah. Yeah. Knowing, to send them back, knowing that this was going to be a test spot for neoliberalism to see how it functions. So the University of Chicago is right in the middle.
One of the reasons why New Chicago is so influential in economics is because the other branches of economics would speak in this time period in very complicated mathematics. They wrote mathematical love poems to socialism oftentimes because no one could understand them. And they could not speak more plainly about what they were writing about. But at the University of Chicago, they could speak plainly. And that made them far more influential.
Right. They were talking about freedom, democracy, individual liberty. You know, they were speaking the language that that Americans like to hear. I think that's a good point. I'm also really pissed off at the Nobel Committee, because giving the economics prize in 74 to Hayek and 76 to Milton Friedman, as I said, made this ideology mainstream.
What he got his PhD, his Nobel Prize for, was very different than what he would speak about as a public person, though.
Yes. All right. Thank you. Let's move on. Deng Xiaoping. Within a vacuum of Communist Party leadership after Mao's death in China, Deng reformed the country into a quasi-capitalist state. His motto was, to get rich is glorious. What communist ever said that? This guy said it. And he is the modern architect of communist mercantile capitalism that China embodies today. Weird.
The one major reform of his, which went against the whole point of the communist revolution in China, was allowing people to own private land and be private farmers. And basically, like, expand through competition, you know, massive land holdings, and basically create a middle class in China, which there had not been for decades.
Yep. And then, where's Maggie May? Margaret Thatcher, the Iron Lady with an iron fist. In a victory over the Labour Party, Thatcher became Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Great Britain, and began gutting the social welfare system and labour unions there. In response to resistance, she boldly claimed, "There is no alternative," meaning to the neoliberal solution, as she saw it. That's 1979. And then in 1980, Ronald Reagan. The bipartisan consensus begun under Carter. Carter was the first person to actually implement neoliberal policies late in the 70s, as he realized Keynesian stimulus wasn't working. So Carter in late 78, 79, 80 was starting to implement neoliberal policies. And then Reagan just took it, you know, all the way. And that is favoring corporations and military power was advanced under Reagan with new energy. In the 1980 election, Reagan asked Americans in his campaign slogan, "Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago?" triggering their insecurities about economic growth and stagflation. So these are the key figures that help bring the whole world into neoliberalism. And then in 1991, when the Soviet Union collapses, we don't have a mortal threat anymore. And now this is what George Bush Sr. Calls the New World Order. So we'll talk about part of that next week. That now the whole world is safe for neoliberal democracy. All right, I would also point everyone to the timeline called A Chronicle of Plausible Deniability, funded by Technical Rationality. Technical rationality means the narrowest technical truth, right, in order to tell a bigger lie. And I'll just read this top part. The U.S. may be the only empire in the history of the world to consistently claim that it is not an empire. Other empires have been administered in clever and even covert ways, but never stooped as low as to insist on their innocence and good intentions, as the U.S. regularly does. The U.S. may be the first empire to be obsessed with its own purity and innocence. The history of the world in this era, 1945 to 80, can be seen as a tug of war between shrewd or sincerely self-deceived spin doctors and apologists for American spheres of influence and those who would expose the true face of American empire, intimidation and financial manipulation to expand and tighten America's control worldwide. And then all of these events, which are not exhaustive, but we think key, help define and advance our understanding of how we get to full-blown neoliberalism, starting with Reagan. Neoliberalism, we don't know the term neoliberalism because it was called Reaganomics. How many of you have heard the term Reaganomics? That's neoliberalism. Right.
Well, what really helps me understand is that this time period is Margaret Thatcher, just that there is no such thing as society. There are only individual men and individual women and families, but the society itself, itself does not exist.
Right. So. That would be like saying there is no church or there is no congregation called Church of All Nations. There's just a whole bunch of individuals sitting here. Right, but collectively, there's no church. I mean, she was a radical individualist, and so was Hayek, and so were Milton Friedman. So individualism is not an innocent ideology. It's a divide-and-conquer strategy for the wealthy and powerful to have control over us because we can't organize ourselves to resist together.
Well, the radical individualism that you're talking about economically that happened in the 80s, that's kind of with the rise of radical individualism with the evangelicalism that rose in the 1980s as well. Yeah. Like, we were just on this individual kick.
Well, I mean, you can see a lot of the targeting of minorities and peaceniks as essentially kind of, you know, push back on people who are the marginal swing voters to the other side. And now we're going to get these whites to vote against economic self-interest so we have more people voting on our side. And hence, you know, in our election system, that means we win. We don't have to get a majority of the votes. We just got to get more votes to the other side. So if we suppress your votes and increase our votes, artificially, we get to win. And the only way you can compete with us is by becoming more like us, which is what the Clintons did. So, I mean, a lot of this is basically kind of trench warfare.
Don't you think that we have a problem with urban versus rural? You know, like, even here in Minnesota.
That's a huge thing now.
Mm-hmm. Right now. Sometimes I feel like I'm very pessimistic about where we are and how we can... I mean, really, the whole movement, even educational institution, you know.
Yeah.
I was there at those high power people. People treated me like token and everything. Mm-hmm. But there, too, how are we going to crack those things down? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Especially...
We'll talk about that more in our fifth session, where we just kind of take a step back and consider all of this together. John?
Yeah, just one thing related to that, because it's right in this time period, so I don't want to get too far into it, but the other thing that happened in the 70s was a transformation of agriculture as we know it, and the emptying of rural areas. So,
yeah.
1973, U.S. Department of Agriculture, Earl Butz, and he tells farmers, got a market in the Soviet Union of all places for grain, plant fence row to fence row, go big or go home, take out loans, machinery, use chemicals, all that stuff, and monocrop, corn, soybeans. And so farmers do it, and the markets are there for a few years. Then inflation, then they take out huge loans. And then inflation rates go up, the market dries up, it disappears, there's nowhere to sell stuff, and farms just go under across the country, late 70s, early 80s. Yeah.
And the power giant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so rural towns, I mean, they do empty out at this time. Everything starts to be transformed, and there's tremendous discontent that starts at this time. But this is because he works for agribusiness. It's, again, a corporate takeover.
Well, we should say again, if we look at theory, that's one thing. But if we look at history, capitalism is closely tied, even dependent on war and slavery and debt. If we can't do war, we'll do slavery. If we can't do slavery, we'll do debt. But capitalism is completely dependent on these three concepts one way or another. And we think that we're exploiting other people, but sooner or later, you know, it comes back to all of us. And another thing I want to kind of remind us of, we'll just say a closing prayer and let people go home if you need to. It's 8:35, and those of us who want to stay, like we did last week, for a little bit more Q&A, we'll do that too. Is just to wrap this section up and remember a couple of key things. One is that Keynesian economics, which is about within the capitalist system, some redistribution, right, basically fails with a combination of a very long Vietnam War and the OPEC oil crisis that we don't have agency over. There's other countries that are doing this. And the other thing is the specter of nuclear war, a totally devastating war with the Soviet Union, and not just the prospect of nuclear war, but Soviet expansionism, because they are actually trying to expand. And even in the 80s, they invaded Afghanistan, but we were also trying to expand. So we have American expansionism and Soviet expansionism, and that meant that as long as the Soviet Union was our primary enemy, anybody or anything that was not the Soviet Union was seen as good. So even though corporations were exploiting us like crazy, as long as it wasn't the Soviet Union, it was on our side. And so we had a favorable view of corporations vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. Does that make sense? So there's a whole bunch of other things that happen. But for the average person, this is why most of us supported the status quo. Because we're like, well, if Keynesian economics doesn't work, what's our alternative? I guess we're going to try, you know, neoliberalism. And if we don't want to be like the Soviet Union, then I guess we should support these corporations, however much they exploit us.
And because that was the prominent option, neoliberalism, because of all the suppression of socialists and other people during that time.
That was not accidental either. All right. Somebody say a prayer for us to conclude this time, and then we'll, right after that, go into a little more Q&A.
Dear God, thank you for us gathering together and learning about our mucked up world and where we are in it, Lord. And the sins of our fathers and mothers that we have inherited, Lord. And thank you for helping to liberate our minds today. And thank you for this time together.
Amen. All right. Go in peace for those who need to.